Jewish Women's Oral History. We are still on the 11th of September at the home of Mr. Morris Shapiro, and this is the fourth tape, first side, and Mr. Shapiro and Gabby Denman and Mary Harrison have decided that we're going to continue this taping, even though it goes over an hour, and we're going to continue on Mr. Shapiro talking about the energy situation.
Okay. I started by saying that in 1970 I participated in two events on the first Earth Day. One was at the University of Toledo, and the other one was at UCLA. I did one the evening before and then flew on the evening to Los Angeles.
Could you tell us what Earth Day really was?
Well, Earth Day was the first national manifestation by then a small group who organized it, but later really by the majority of the people in the United States, that the time had come to reverse the kind of environmental decline that had been going on since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but which was accelerating in since the end of World War II. And the governmental manifestations of that were the beginning of the Clean Water Act, which was back in the 40s, and the original Clean Air Act, which I believe was in the 60s, and other legislation, both national and local. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which was ravished by such things as acid mine waste due to the legacy of coal mining in the state and the resulting degradation of streams by the acid that's produced as water flows in through abandoned mines.
Does that occur with strip mining as well?
Strip mining
and
deep
actual
mining,
coal.
Right. Okay. It depends upon the availability of pyrites above and below the coal seam, and then water and oxidation that occurs, both biological and physical, that produces the acid. And there, excuse me.
Okay, we're talking about the pollution.
Talking about, evolution of environmental concerns and environmental...
Leading up to Earth Day.
Yeah. Well, all of these aspects became common, in a sense, of a larger number of people being concerned about it. And then some enterprising individuals thought up of the idea of having an Earth Day. And as you may remember, it was in 1970 that the Environmental Protection Agency Act was promulgated in Congress, and the establishment of that agency.
So the EPA is only since 1970?
Correct.
That's funny, I didn't know that.
Correct.
Who were some of these people that you mentioned? Do you have names of people?
Well, the only one that comes to mind at the moment is former senator from Maine. I can't think of his name.
Muskie. God, I forgot about him.
Who really, at that time in the 60s and early 70s, was the legislative and governmental leader in the field. At that time, as you know, as a former public health service officer and knowledge of what the public health service tried to do, when, for example, you have to, it's interesting to note that in 1911, the public health service established a water pollution research laboratory in Cincinnati, which was concerned with activities on with what was happening on the Ohio River. And during World War II, obviously had been authorized earlier, the Corps of Engineers of the U.S. had conducted a major study on the Ohio River to catalog. And I have one copy of the three volumes of that report, which is now way out of print, which was to document the amount of pollutants that were entering the Ohio River. The Public Health Service, because of its nature, was not a self-aggrandizing kind of agency. It was actually reluctant to make waves in that sense, and the people who were concerned with water pollution at the time thought of the Public Health Service more as an educational agency rather than a regulatory agency. And it was on that's one of the primary bases upon which the notion was that you have to legislate regulation. But on the other side of the coin is that such people as Streeter and Professor Phelps, who developed the rather famous Streeter-Phelps equation, which related to the effects of pollutants on streams and the deoxygenation of streams, started working in 1911. So that there was a long history to it, but it was tiny little steps in terms of the total problem. And when it became really overwhelming, that was it. Well, the same thing happened in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania actually started, the Clean Streams Act of Pennsylvania as one of the forerunners. It came before the EPA Act was established, and even before the 1948 Clean Water Act, that was a federal act that was administered. The administration was in the Public Health Service first, then there was an agency within the Department of Interior, and then subsequently they established EPA.
The EPA also, I think, economically was a very, very challenging thing to industry, wasn't it? Because there were many, many businesses who had to clean up their act, and that became a major issue, didn't it?
Well, that major issue still goes on. It goes on right at this moment in Allegheny County. There's a plant that wants to establish itself in McKeesport, a depressed area, to print on that foil material, which is used in chewing gum and things of wrappers and things of that nature. The printing process and the whole process produces volatile organic compounds, one of them being ammonia, for example. Well, ammonia is not an organic compound, but there are other, they have solvents, but they produce ammonia and other, and some volatile organic compounds. And the question that I keep hearing, or the comments from those who are involved in regulation, because they have to get a permit for it, is, well, if you're going to control them too much, there won't be built here, and therefore there won't be jobs. Well, all that means really is that those kinds of regulations have to be universal rather than local in terms of it, so that kind of, it's a similar question that existed in terms of labor costs.
I understand. I'd like to go back a little bit more back into the Earth Day
mm-hmm.
into the whether you remember any particular people. How do you feel that it was organized, so that it became, you know, it was a world.
No, it wasn't national. It wasn't
national,
world
but I thought that the European community.
Well, the European took it on later.
Okay, so it was strictly the United States.
You remember there was an international environment conference in Stockholm in 1972.
Okay, all right. So the and 1970 was strictly the USA.
Exactly, the USA, but it affected this. Then there was such things, you know, the. Club of Rome, which developed really a doom scenario of what was happening to the globe. As an individual, probably a person like René Dubos, of his the microbiologist who started working on tuberculosis. Then became working on really on human and world ecology, and his thoughts and his pronouncements as to what was happening and what was required in order to reverse trends or at least redirect things was very influential in terms of activities. And then there were individual organizations that did the same thing. Not the least being the Sierra Club and others, and some of them, in a sense, more militant than others, but all in consort, working. There is now, for example, exists in the country a Clean Air Coalition, which is trying to bring together the various groups that work in the air in relation to air pollution. But you also see, at the same time, really, there's a proliferation of organizations that are working in the area, and in a sense, if they can exist, that may be a measure of the need for it. You would think that, from a logical point of view, there should be more togetherness, but obviously there are individual perceptions of what the problems are and how to deal with them. There are individual agendas related to it, some of them not as unselfish as you would think they should be, but nevertheless dealing with the problem.
They take ownership, don't they?
They take ownership, but one of the major not complaints, but criticisms of some of the environmental groupings were that these were really middle and upper middle class organizations who were trying to protect their own turf as opposed to thinking of the total problem, one of which obviously exists, just like in the Soviet Union right now, in terms of shutting down these horribly polluting areas, is that people will be out of work. Well, now obviously, from my point of view, the need is dual. It's dealing with the human problem on the one hand and dealing with the environmental problem on the other. And if you don't co-join them, if you're just dealing with one aspect, you're doing as much damage as if you're doing nothing. And that is a major concern. That has been a concern of mine for some time.
What about nuclear energy?
We were some of the first to conduct a study on the Ohio River pre the establishment of the Shippingport Atomic Energy Plant, which was, as you may know, the first in the world, the first atomic energy plant. What we were doing
was where?
It was in Shippingport, Pennsylvania, okay. Which is about 20 miles downstream from the point on the Ohio River. I believe it's 20 miles. That shipping port was 1957, I think so. 1957, right. And we, with the group from the Department of Biology, conducted this pre-establishment, pre-operational study to find out what the radioactivity levels in the Ohio River were at the time to establish a baseline. So we even been involved with it for a long time. I also, in the early days, in the late 50s, brought to Pittsburgh the environmental manager from the Hanford Atomic, from the Hanford plants in Washington, you know, where plutonium is made. And he gave us a seminar on what was happening with the high-level waste that they have. And you may have read in the papers today the same problems that existed then still exist now, namely storage of these high-level liquid waste, high-level from the point of view of radioactivity. Two things are involved. Number one, it's obvious that as one of the alternative energy sources, every kind of effort that is possible and feasible to study this alternative energy, as in the same manner as studying fusion as a possible source of usable energy, or, if you will, biomass energy, renewable energy from that point of view, I think it should be studied and evaluated. The problem that I've always perceived has been, from my environmental perspective, has been that ever since we were dealing with it at the start, my colleagues in the environmental engineering area and in the radiation protection area have always been claiming that there's no technical reason why we cannot deal with a high-level waste problem. But as you know, that has not been the case so far. In other words, every solution that has been, or every means of dealing with this high-level, long-lived radioactivity that has been proposed has come to naught. Now, at this time, the presumption is that Yucca Mountain site in Nevada will be feasible, but that's still to be proven. So from that point of view, there is a really difficult question to be answered. We have answered, but only partially so, the question of general safety. And there's no doubt that the Chernobyl situation was due to the kind of human error that is bound to occur. And since you know that human errors are bound to occur, you have to have redundancy in the manner in which you provide safeguards so that whatever human error is, no matter how gross it is or even how fine it is in the sense of just a minor kind of thing, that it would be overridden by the redundancy that's available in order to control the situation. So that from my point of view, there are still two major problems to the proliferation of nuclear energy as an alternative energy source. And at the same time, let me state right away that as we sit here and every day that passes and there's no new Chernobyl or no new Three Mile Island problem, that's all to the good. What we still, from the health point of view, are really ignorant of is the whole question of the long-range health effects. I just happened to, I'm trying to throw out some stuff from my office, and I came through. You may know that we had a faculty member here for years by the name of Ernie Sternglass,
mm-hmm.
who...
he's a brother-in-law of a friend of mine.
Right.
Be careful what you say.
No. Ernie and I are friends, even though I disagree with him on things. But he's been a consistent, and I don't know what he's doing right now, but he's always been a consistent critic of nuclear energy because of his faith in the notion that low-level radioactivity and exposure to radioactivity is very damaging in the long run. And, well, right now at the School of Public Health, there is a proposal to conduct a study of airline pilots to try and evaluate their exposure to radiation from space, and because they're so high, fly high, and are exposed to it more than you or I are exposed to it, because they fly all the time, and that kind of information is needed before you can really arrive at a better understanding of the totality of this kind of a hazard. I would suspect that new nuclear energy plants are not going to be built until, number one, there is an acceptable solution to the high-level waste problem. Number two, there are really acceptable, information and in that sense also acceptance of safety controls, because we're finding out now what Chernobyl did. I mean, we're just finding out, and it'll take 20 or 30 years before you'll find out more. And that kind of assurance is necessary that nothing like that can happen.
Would you please explain what happened to Chernobyl in a capsule?
Well,
where it is, and why the information is so late in coming out.
Well, Chernobyl is located in the Soviet Union, in the Ukraine, near Kiev, near the big city of Kiev. And it's a complex of nuclear plants, four of them, I believe.
And how long have they been there?
That I don't know, but at least 10 or 15 years. Maybe even more. I really don't know how long they were there. But there was a human error in people trying to run an experiment on a plant. And these are different than our nuclear power plants. This is a gas-cooled kind of a graphite. No, it's a graphite-moderated nuclear power plant. It's quite different than the pressurized water power plants we have here. I'm not sure whether they're similar to the one that was the Windscale nuclear plant in Great Britain, which also had a problem. That was in the early days. Anyway, I'm doing this from memory. There was an experiment that operators were trying to conduct, which was not authorized, and things went haywire, and tremendous explosion and fire occurred, and with a huge amount of radioactive material spewed forth into the atmosphere, into areas and across the Soviet Union, primarily in the surrounding area in a radius of tens and hundreds of miles, but also then in a long-range transport carried to Scandinavia, for example. I think some of it arrived in Canada as well. And so it was a disaster of horrendous magnitude. The only thing that could have been worse, a lot more people would have been killed right outright, but there were relatively few that were killed, I think, right outright. It's the question of what is happening to those kids growing there, the fact that so many people had to be evacuated, that a whole town was abandoned, that milk even now has to be imported into the region from areas which are presumed to be radiation-free, and that kind of thing. So those are the kinds of aspects in relation to nuclear power that...
Wasn't it the fact that there was gas that had to do with that, or...?
No. What I was trying to emphasize is that the principle in which that nuclear power plant operates is different than the ones that were designed in the United States.
Which do you feel are better?
Well, that only time will tell, because I don't know whether if that human error would have not occurred there, or there was more redundancy that could not have been mitigated, or at least reduced in its enormity. That I'm not capable of saying. Most people, I think, would say this, that the pressure reactors are inherently safer. However, Three Mile Island, well, maybe that is the thing, because it also was a human error, and only a relatively small amount of radiation escaped there versus the amount that escaped at Chernobyl.
How could you, were you to be the designer of, how would you successfully dispose of nuclear waste?
Well, I don't know if we can answer the question. These wastes are not like organic wastes. They're physical wastes that have high levels of radioactivity, with the added problem that goes on for 20,000 years. So that...
There's no way of deactivating?
There are possibilities of reprocessing the plutonium, and that's, I think, what's done in Europe, in France in particular, but I'm really not capable of giving you that kind of information. That's
all right.
An area that I'm not my expertise.
Okay. Would you like to go on, or do you want to end?
I, if you want to go
Gabby,
on.
Gabby, how about you? Sure. I'd like you to tell us a little bit, it can be very short and brief, just your social life in Pittsburgh and your family vacations and hobbies and religion. I think we already have covered that you have no formal.
No formal affiliation.
Right. Yeah. And social life in Pittsburgh?
Wide and extensive.
Okay.
I don't know how to explain it. Well, I'll take it historically. When we first came to Pittsburgh, soon after our arrival, we found a house out in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, and immediately made some good friends. Well, we had colleagues who lived out there, but also made good friends in the community. And we lived there from 1951 through 1964. And It's always been very pleasant. We still are, not in daily touch or even otherwise, but still are friendly with people who we had been friendly with there at that time. Some of them are no longer with us, obviously. And that was an interesting kind of a situation. We were with, and very similar to our family situation, I don't know if you remember, Dr. Leslie Falk, who used to live in Pittsburgh. They lived not far from us, but I suppose he and I were the only two Jews living in the North Hills at the time. Right now, I understand there's even a temple in the North Hills.
Oh, there is.
Yes, there is a temple in the North Hills. But at that time, we were the only ones. There was an exception. They didn't live there. The other one who lived there was Jonas Salk, who lived in even further than we did. And then his brother arrived and
Is that the pediatrician? Developed,
no, not the pediatrician, the veterinarian.
Okay.
Who developed the animal farm, the laboratory animal farm. I can't remember the man who